I hope you enjoyed this week's all-new episode of Star Trek Discovery, available on CBS All Access. So, I've rounded up some of our fantastic guests to give us their reactions to this week's incredible episode, and here is what they had to say.
Hey, this is Jeff Bond. I'm editor of Geek Magazine, and I'm here to talk about the Discovery episode Perpetual Infinity. We're getting toward the end of Discovery's second season, and it's fair to talk about how it's measured up to the show's very bumpy first year, where it truly seemed like the show's creators sometimes weren't sure where the series was headed from one episode to the next. Season 2 has been much more sure-footed about what it's trying to do, so your mileage may vary depending on whether you like what that is or not. Last week, we got the revelation that the Red Angel was Burnham's mother, Gabrielle, played rather powerfully by The Wire's Sonja Sohn. What has worked for me about the whole Red Angel plot is the way it's played out through Burnham's personal life, specifically her relationship with Spock and her memories of her upbringing on Vulcan, all of which has resonated more than the show's musings about Section 31 and its rogue AI, which is apparently responsible for everything. In Perpetual Infinity, we see Section 31's hapless Captain Leland taken over by the AI in a very, very Borg-like way. And we also see Giorgio and Tyler fighting against the controlled Leland the way any self-respecting Star Trek heroes would. One of the big fan arguments about Discovery is that it's somehow a betrayal of Gene Roddenberry's vision due to characters like Captain Lorca, Giorgio, and Tyler, who are shown doing some pretty awful things. But Discovery's showrunners have actually tended to reinforce the more Pollyannish motivations of their characters in ways that fit in perfectly with Roddenberry's vision, but tend to undermine the show's drama. If Mirror Universe Giorgio can't be shown as entirely evil, and in fact is now shown as a very loyal and somewhat moral ally of Burnham's, then I guess there are no truly morally compromised characters in Star Trek after all. Just as the first part of the season seemed to set Section 31 as the guiding hand behind all of Klingon politics, now we're at the point where the control AI is apparently behind everything bad, so not to worry, all Star Trek people are good. We'll see how this plays out, but it sure seems like an optimistic view of humanity to me. Sonequa Martin-Green continues to have the most insanely challenging role in the series, and they often seem to be throwing too much at her just to see what degree of difficulty she can handle. In her wake-up scene here, she has to come up with about 5 expressions in the space of a few seconds as she registers all the revelations piling up about her mother and everything else. But there is a strong idea there about Gabrielle Burnham having hardened herself against any feelings about her daughter due to her ongoing, futile attempts to save the future from being wiped out by control. I've watched you die 100 times. If you don't feel at least a twinge of pain hearing that line as a parent, you're more Borg than human.
Hi, this is Lisa Klink with my quick review of Perpetual Infinity. I liked it better than the last episode. We got a few answers anyway about, like, why, if Mom had a suit that could go anywhere in space and time, she didn't just come back. Apparently she couldn't, or at least couldn't stay very long in any one particular place. But she could stay long enough with Spock at some point to communicate to him the whole vision of the future apocalypse. And I'm not sure why, again, she communicated that to him and not to her own daughter, or at least a simpler message to her own daughter. So I'm not 100% satisfied, but I guess I will go with it. I definitely like that their reunion was brief and kind of rushed and not at all gushy. I mean, there were some tears, but it wasn't as over the top as it could have been. I thought that Sonequa Martin-Green did a very nice job of conveying a lot of really complicated emotions without an awful lot of it coming out in dialogue. I think she's doing really well with the unspoken feelings that we can see all over her face. So I certainly appreciated that. I like the AI bad guy being personified in Leland. I'm still a little wary about an AI being our big bad for the season. I mean, unless it takes physical form again and again in different physical forms or always shows up as a hologram, I don't know. I kind of like my bad guys to be in person and where you can fight them. Like, I really like the fight with Leland and Giorgio. So I would like to see more of that kind of bad guy rather than a in the ether kind of bad guy that requires our people to report, oh, wait a minute, the AI has downloaded this much percentage of all the information in the universe, and this is really bad. I don't want it all to be off of display screens. I would really like my enemies to be standing there where I can, you know, kick them in the face. Well, me being, of course, them. So that's my brief review, and I am looking forward to next week.
Hi there, my name is Alexandra August, and here are my thoughts on Star Trek Discovery's Perpetual Infinity. Overall, I really liked this episode, especially given I felt like it was a really nice departure from last week's kind of what felt like just a massive info dump in the Red Angel. We got to see so much dynamic characterization this week from the incredibly powerful work from Sonequa Martin-Green dealing with first her mother's return and then the implications of how what her mother has been through for the past 20/thousands of years, depending on how you look at it. I thought it was an incredible comment on parental loss and how once you grow past a certain point, even if that parent walked back into your life, it would still not erase the trauma and the hole that they left. Thought that was an incredibly, that point was incredibly eloquently made, as was just the larger tragedy of Gabrielle's existence. So, Sonia Sohn is such a brilliant, brilliant actress, and I thought that she conveyed Gabrielle's well-deserved cynicism and yet, you know, bolstered it with a little bit of hope and feeling toward the end, really made me tear up. I also enjoyed the scenes between Spock and Burnham as they're kind of repairing their rift, and Spock is and acting more like siblings. Thought that was pretty incredible. I also really enjoyed Georgiou's scene with Gabrielle Burnham, especially given that we rarely see Georgiou is someone we rarely see at a lower status than anyone else in the room. She always seems to be more confident and seems to feel more powerful than anyone that she's opposite, regardless of whether or not they outrank her or have a more focused moral compass. But she definitely seemed a little low-key intimidated by Gabrielle, and I thought that was a nice expression of how she's appears to be growing into a more emotional and therefore vulnerable person, at least in with regard to Michael Burnham. I'm not sure, it still doesn't quite sit well with me that her early characterization as Empire of the as Emperor of the Terran Empire. I don't know that I totally believe a person like that could have this much of a fluidic shift in their characterization, but I think Michelle Yeoh is selling it really well, and I did not mind watching her kick the crap out of Leland. I felt like we finally got a fight scene where we could really see what she can do, and that was incredibly satisfying to watch. Also satisfying was Leland turning into the villain that we've needed this season. His merging with Control has turned him into someone who is far more competent and far more certain than the human Leland that we've met. And I loved that the minute Georgiou gets wind of Leland's confidence and competence, she immediately knows something's up. That made me laugh a little bit. But Alan Von Sprang is doing an amazing job. And I actually find myself now a little bit frightened of Control now that it's manifested itself into a more tangible villainy. Beyond that, I loved actually the technobabble sequences we got this episode between Burnham and Stamets and Spock and Pike when they're trying to figure out how to send the sphere data so far into the future, but somehow keep Gabrielle Burnham tethered here so she's not consigned to a life of loneliness and just despair 1,000 years into the future when there are no other sentient life forms to keep her company or help her get back because then she'll be without the suit. That was some interesting science for the first time. It sort of balanced out the idea of a time crystal on the black market, which I always just rang a little bit silly to me. I get that Star Trek is full of things that aren't possible, but usually they ground their future tech in a little bit more science and physics than something like a time crystal was, even though I know that time crystal is an actual scientific concept. It is not. Doesn't have anything to do with time travel. So anyway, but silly gripe. And then beyond that, I enjoyed the stakes being raised that now that Tyler is sort of grievously injured and trying to figure out a way to get home. And I'm not sure how much I really like the fact that this cat has 9 lives and we're going to revisit his baby next week, which as much as I love Mary Chifo and love Laurel, I just feel like this storyline is not, it's just sort of tacked on and doesn't really gel well with the rest of the season. But I still like the concept of it well enough. And finally, I thought it was very touching that, and very good representation of neurodivergency and how well it can be valued, that Spock's dyslexia-type disorder results in him being the only person who can perceive Gabrielle as the Red Angel. And the fact that it's Michael who manages to give him that message almost feels like she's balanced out a little bit from traumatizing him so badly when she left ages ago when they were children by calling him a little freak. I don't think she was doing it in order to make up for a past sin, but it felt like she was finally being the sister, or finally allowed to be the sister that she desperately wanted to be without fear of any repercussion or putting Spock in danger. So all in all, enjoyed this episode quite a bit, from the title to the execution. And I'm very much looking forward to next week and perhaps learning more about who caused these signals. By the way, I do not believe for one second that Burnham Sr. has no idea what they are or where they came from. She denied that a little bit too quickly. So I'm curious to know the origins. I might not be right, but there it is. I also can't end this without making some kind of mention that there are a lot of Borg similarities, to the point where Control actually says to Leland, struggle is pointless, actually co-opts him to be their voice, just as they co-opted Picard to be Locutus. So it's another bald captain getting assimilated. It was just, if they're not going somewhere or somehow relating Control to the Borg, this was a pretty naked ripoff of Borg rhetoric. And so on the one hand, I really don't want the Borg to be shoehorned into Discovery. It feels like a naked grab for nostalgia porn. And on the other hand, though, I don't know how they couldn't introduce the Borg after this episode, because if they don't, it is just going to feel like a naked ripoff. And I feel like Discovery has been unfairly accused of that in the past, but this would be a very fair accusation, if the similarities between Control and the Borg and the seemingly undeniable references to Borg-like behavior and Borg-like phrases went unanswered. So I guess we'll see. We'll see where that goes. There's still a couple of episodes left. Thanks, folks, and please tune in next week for yet more thoughts on Star Trek Discovery.
Greetings, all. It's J.D. Voick once again, bringing you your weekly moment of disco science. We open this episode with the Burnham family, well, Michael specifically, waiting for the star Alpha Lupi to undergo supernova, a violent fate for stars over 8 times the mass of our own. That might not sound like it's that much bigger, but in terms of the overall stellar population, less than 1% of all stars are that big. Alpha Lupi is a real star, the brightest in the constellation Lupus, and at about 460 light-years from Earth, it's one of the closest supernova candidates. It's classified as a B-type star, which means it's bluish-white in color and about 10 times the mass of our Sun. But mass and luminosity don't scale the same when it comes to stars, so it also radiates over 20,000 times as much energy per second. That means it's going to run out of fuel way faster than our Sun will. It's currently less than 20 million years old, compared to the Sun's 4.6 billion, and probably only has another few million years left in it. Now, I'm not saying that it can't explode in just a few hundred years, but human lives are so fleeting that the chance of any one specific star exploding when you're there to watch is astronomically tiny. But when you scale things out to, say, the entire Milky Way, you get about 1 to 2 supernovas every century, on average. According to observations, the last one happened about 150 years ago, so statistically speaking, we're due for one. But usually, they're too far away to see with the naked eye, or they're blocked by interstellar dust. The most recent supernova that actually looked like a new star in the night sky was all the way back in 1604. There was also one, for the record, in 1572. So that's the only reason I'm jealous of the people who would have been alive back then. They didn't have indoor plumbing, but they got to see 2 freaking supernovas in their lifetime, and I could very well have none. At least none that I could see without a telescope. because telescopes capture supernovas from far-flung galaxies all the time now. Like, guess how many supernovas we detected in 2018? I'll give you a moment to ballpark it. Got a number? Is it around 7,600? Because it's about 7,600. Now, not all of those got official fancy supernova names, as fancy as catalog names get, but that comes out to just under 20 a day. Granted, our technology is only so sensitive, so we're not finding the super far away and therefore faint supernovas. And because light can only travel so fast, but the universe is expanding, there are parts of the universe we won't ever be able to see. So Michael's quote about there being a supernova every second in the universe isn't ridiculous. One thing that might seem a bit ridiculous, though, is what Michael was able to look through her telescope and see. Not the features of the image itself, but the fact that she could see any features at all. Stars appear as single points of light through even the most powerful of telescopes, because unless you're on a planet orbiting it closely enough, they're just too far away. For stars like our sun, the ones not massive enough to explode, they lose their outer gaseous layers, basically shedding them into the nearby void as they die. The remaining bit of star still shines, a collapsed core that we call a white dwarf, illuminating those gases and creating very pretty nebulae. And some of those are large enough and close enough that you can image them with a decent backyard telescope. A popular target for beginner astrophotographers is the Dumbbell Nebula, but that nebula has had a good 10,000 years to grow in size. Now it's roughly 2 light-years across, which is half the distance from the sun to the next star over. Supernova remnants suffer the same issue. One of the most famous is the Crab Nebula. Its star went supernova about 7,500 years ago, and humans observed it back in 1054. And since then, the nebula keeps getting bigger. It currently clocks in at about a dozen light-years across. If you were to look at a star before its core collapses, the outer layers won't have gotten very far away, meaning you'd either have to have a very large telescope, which Burnham doesn't, or be incredibly close to see any detail. Dangerously close. Like, in the very same system. And, as young Burnham states, supernovas release as much energy in a few seconds as some stars do in their entire lifetimes. In fact, astronomers gave that amount of energy its own unit. It's called a FOE, an acronym derived from the amount of energy released. 10 to the power of 51 ergs. Our sun, in its 10 billion year lifespan, will emit roughly 1.2 FOEs, assuming that its current luminosity stays the same. Even more surprising, that's only about 1% of the energy actually created during a core collapse. The other 99% is carried away by ghostly particles called neutrinos just before the actual supernova. But even that 1% can rip a world apart. So, naturally, the further away you are, the safer you are. According to models, planets that orbit a supernova-going star could survive, but be flung out to wander the void of the cosmos alone. Others still could settle into new orbits around the baby remnant. But some astronomers predict that a supernova as far as 30 light-years away, in other words, several star systems over, could still bathe a planet in enough radiation to cause a mass extinction. Let us all hope that the Burnham's lab has shielding. This has been J.D. Voigt with your Moment of Disco Science. Until next time.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jeff, Alexandra, and Lisa. Really always a pleasure to have you and your voices here on the show. And thanks to you guys. Thank you, our audience, for joining us for Disco Nights. And if you're a fan of this podcast, you may want to check out Electric Surge's other podcasts, including 4:30 Movie every Friday and Inglourious Trekspurts, the podcast about all things Trek with co-hosts Mark Altman and Darren Doctorman. It's available every Saturday evening at 1701 hours. That's not 1702, by the way, 1701, wherever you listen to podcasts. A very special thanks to Bill Ritter, our engineer, and everybody here at Electric Surge. And we really appreciate you making the show possible. Join us next Sunday and every Sunday for an all-new disco party to make sure you bring your disco shoes. This is Chase Masterson saying disco lives, and I'll see you next week.
This podcast is a production of the Electric Surge Network.